From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, saxophonist Branford Marsalis. He's a member of one of America's most famous jazz families. His father is pianist Ellis Marsalis. His brother, trumpeter Wynton Marsalis. But when Branford first told his father he wanted to play jazz, his father laughed. We'll find out why. Also, we'll hear from Branford's brother, Wynton. He's a 9-time Grammy Award winner and was the first jazz musician to receive the Pulitzer Prize. And film critic David Edelstein reviews two films opening this week, Wimbledon and Mr. 3000. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Rain left over from Hurricane Ivan has been drenching parts of the southern Appalachians over the last day. Officials in rural Ray County, Tennessee, say flooding forced hundreds of residents to seek shelter. Matt Schaefer Powell reports from WUOT in Knoxville.
Spring City is a small Tennessee town of about 2,000 people, located a little more than 60 miles southwest of Knoxville. Jeff Knight of the Ray County Sheriff's Office says rain forced water from nearby Piney Creek to spill out into Spring City. The water washed away some mobile homes and did major damage to many of the businesses in town, but he says there were no serious injuries.
Spring City is notorious for flooding, especially in the north end of town, and we're just very, very fortunate that it wasn't worse than it was.
25 miles away in the town of Harriman, authorities believe Thursday night's heavy rains were responsible for the death of a local police officer. A 3-year veteran of the force died after his patrol car hydroplaned off the road. For NPR News, I'm Matt Schaefer Powell in Knoxville.
The death toll from Hurricane Ivan has risen to 35 in the U.S., and that's on top of more than 70 lives lost in the Caribbean. Meanwhile, Tropical Storm Jean has been downgraded to a tropical depression with winds of 35 miles per hour. The Florida Supreme Court ruled today that Ralph Nader must be allowed on the state's presidential ballot in November. The justices voted 6-1 to put the independent candidate's name on the ballot. Nader's name was put forward by the Reform Party in Florida, but state Democrats had argued that the Reform Party wasn't a valid political party and that it had failed to qualify Nader through a petition process or a primary vote. Democrats fear that Nader will draw more votes from Senator John Kerry than from President Bush. In Abuja, Nigeria today, peace talks between Sudan and rebel groups of Darfur broke up without agreement. They're scheduled to resume next month. Sudan has accused the U.S. of making the situation worse. NPR's Michelle Kelman has more.
After the Nigerian-mediated talks ended with no agreement, a Sudanese official pinned the blame on Washington, saying recent comments by U.S. officials sent the wrong signal to the rebels. State Department spokesman Adam Airlie rejected this.
Obviously, any suggestion that somehow the United States' determination of genocide had a negative impact to the talks, we would reject outright.
The Bush administration blames Sudan and its proxy militias of genocide against black farming communities in Darfur. Washington hopes to get a new United Nations resolution on Sudan this weekend to endorse a larger African Union force. As for the peace talks, Sudan and Darfur's rebel groups are expected to restart negotiations in a month on humanitarian and security issues. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow gained 40 to 10,284. The Nasdaq was up 6 to 1910. This is NPR News. NASA scientists are expressing new optimism that they'll get useful data out of the Genesis spacecraft that crashed last week in the Utah desert. The Genesis capsule is still being cleaned and dismantled in a special clean room at a remote Army base. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
A NASA status report on the Genesis mission says scientists are becoming more enthusiastic about the capsule and its contents the more they meticulously pick it apart. They've removed the canister containing most of the mission's science experiments and have it sitting upside down, slowly trimming away small portions of the canister wall from bottom to top. Fragments of wafers embedded with samples of solar wind have been removed. Still inside is a 4-part solar wind concentrator. Scientists believe 3 of its 4 sections are relatively intact, the 4th seems fractured. the $260 million three-year mission was supposed to end with a mid-air capture. Instead, the Genesis capsule plunged to Earth when its parachutes failed to open. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
U.S. military officials in Iraq say American and Iraqi government troops arrested dozens of suspected militants today in a sweep through central Baghdad. They say the troops rounded up 63 people, including Syrians, Sudanese, and Egyptian nationals, as well as a store of grenades, rockets, and other weapons. As the sweep was going on, a car bomber drove into a police checkpoint and blew himself up, killing 8 people and injuring more than 20. U.S. officials say American troops stopped another attempted car bombing by shooting a car as it approached their blockade. The car blew up, killing the 2 people inside. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. As you might suspect of somebody who spent a couple of years as the band leader on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, saxophonist Branford Marsalis is funny as well as being a great musician. Branford is from one of the best-known families in jazz. One of his brothers is the trumpeter and composer Wynton Marsalis. We'll hear from him later in the show. Their father is pianist Ellis Marsalis. Branford has had several different public identities as a musician. His group Buckshot LaFunk combined jazz and hip-hop. In the pop world, he's performed with Sting, The Grateful Dead, and Bruce Hornsby. And he's recorded many jazz albums as the leader of the Branford Marsalis Quartet. His latest recording is a collection of ballads called Eternal. From that CD, here's The Ruby and the Pearl, a ballad made famous by Nat King Cole. The Ruby and the Pearl, from the new Branford Marsalis CD, Eternal. Terry Gross spoke with Branford in 2002. He told her about a turning point in his life, hearing the John Coltrane recording, A Love Supreme.
I think I was probably at the Berklee College of Music the first time I heard it, or maybe it was at my dad's house, it was 18, 19, something.
But what year would this be about?
78, 79, 77, somewhere around there. I was very uncomfortable. Because I just had, there was nothing that I'd ever done or listened to in my life that could adequately prepare me for that experience. And there was a lot of discomfort on my end. I just wanted them to turn it off as quickly as possible.
What was making you so uncomfortable?
It's just when you hear something that you've never heard before. It's something that I see in a lot of people the first time they hear jazz. And the first time they hear it played well, or the first time they hear it played differently than what they're used to hearing on a lot of jazz radio stations. And I remember it well because I just didn't have anything to reference it to. I was a kid. I grew up listening to Elton John and Led Zeppelin. And
but your father, Ellis Marsalis, is a pianist who plays jazz, so you grew up hearing that too.
That's what he did.
Right.
That's not what I did.
Right.
I was a kid, and I listened to a lot of pop music. And I had a couple of Charlie Parker records that I'd learned some solos from. One was called Fiesta, and it was like Bird playing with a Latin percussion section. The record's really corny, which lends me to believe, you know, Norman Granz had a big hand in that one, because, you know, it's like with my blue suede shoes and all these really little cute pop ditties. And Bird plays his tail off, but they're short solos, one chorus, at tops, two choruses, on short 12 and 16 bar forms. And yeah, I just never, that John Coltrane train thing, Love Supreme, it just comes out like, you know, Elvin's hitting a gong, and the music comes in, and you're just like, man, what is this? What is this? I didn't really have an understanding of the blues. I mean, I knew that the blues was a 12 bar form, but I didn't really have any real personal understanding of the blues idiom and its impact on jazz. And the first movement of A Love Supreme is basically straight blues. So I just wasn't intellectually or professionally or, you know, musically prepared for the onslaught.
Well, why don't we hear your version of A Love Supreme? We'll hear the opening movement.
Great.
Up in what is now America's probably most famous jazz family, the Marsalis family. Your father, Ellis Marsalis, is a pianist. When you were growing up liking the pop music that you liked, did you feel about his music the way, say, I felt about my father's old Benny Goodman records?
I felt about my father's music the way that my next-door neighbor felt about his father, the chauffeur driver. That was just what he did.
Uh-huh.
How did you feel about your father's
Benny
Goodman
records? Guess I didn't. I really disliked them until I got much older. Well, in my 20s, anyways.
Jazz is not for kids. And I know there's an argument. My brother says jazz can be for kids. I don't think jazz has a level of sophistication that's just way too hip for kids. It's not a music for kids, and it certainly wasn't a music for me. But it wasn't like he'd play them and I'd go, arr. I would just leave the room.
He just didn't care.
And turn on the television in the other room until it was my turn to listen to my music, and then I put on Cheech and Chong and Elton John and, you know, James Brown and whatever I wanted to put on, and my father would stay out, and then when James Brown came on, he'd come in and say, yeah, kid, yeah, Jack, I like that. And then he would always dance to it. When he danced to it, he would snap his fingers on 2 and 4, which was the funniest thing in the world, you know?
That's great.
You know,
yeah.
Cold sweats going on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like a cold sweat, dun, 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 do ba da do do dee da. My father's going, yeah. I'm like, no, Dad. It's just funny.
It's on the one.
Oh yeah, it was classic.
That's great. So, what was your first instrument?
My first instrument was the piano, and then when I was a freshman, when I was in the first grade or second grade, went and started playing the trumpet, and I wanted to play an instrument, so I said, I want to play the trumpet, and my father says, no, we're not going to have two people playing the same instrument in the same household. So you have to pick something else. So, okay, clarinet. Okay, fine, you get the clarinet. And I played the clarinet for 7 years until I was a sophomore in high school, and then I switched to the alto saxophone because I wanted to be in a funk band.
Yeah, that's the thing. There are no clarinets in funk bands.
And if there were, it would be really bad. It wouldn't work. It wouldn't be a good vibe at all.
How did you end up feeling about clarinet when you were playing it? Because they weren't featured at all in the kind of pop music you were listening to.
Not
Elton John or James Brown.
I was in the orchestra. I was in the wind ensemble. I didn't care. You know, I wasn't. That was like a separate thing. That was the music
right.
I liked, but it wasn't necessarily the music You know, the only of all that music, the only time I ever envisioned myself being on stage doing it was when I was listening to Elton John religiously, and I would play the piano and I'd learn all his songs. You know, Burn On the Mission and, you know, Daniel and Rocket Man, and I'd play the piano and say, one day I'm going to be on the stage playing these songs on the piano. When I stopped playing piano, that whole thing went away, because you go from being the front man to in the horn section, which is like a whole different thing. It's not really the most romantic gig in the world to be in the horn section of a rock star or, you know, a pop band. It's just, you're just in the horn section. That's the way it goes. So playing clarinet was fine for me. It was a different thing.
Once you got into the horn sections of bands, what are some of the bands in which you were in the horn section?
Oh, well, the one that we had in New Orleans was a band we called the Mighty Creators. And it was the funniest band. It was an R&B band. And there was another band that went and joined and got me into called Killer Force and the Crispy Critters. And then there was one other band that I can't remember the name of. But the band we spent the most time in was the Creators. What was that other band I was in? Stop Incorporated. I played keyboard in Stop Incorporated. And there was another band called that other rival bands, Jam Incorporated and Flashback and all these bands, Chocolate Milk. And the Creators were interesting because I learned a lot about, I don't know what you really call it, but we had a band that was probably technically the best funk band in New Orleans. I mean, we could play music that these other guys could only dream of playing, but we weren't a funky band at all. Our drummer and bass player just didn't have groove. So we would be playing all this music and all the musicians would be there, and the audience would just be bored to tears hearing us play because they couldn't feel anything. And then the next band, a band like Flashback, would come on where they didn't have half the technique we had, and they would just hit a simple groove, and then the people would just be up and dancing and going crazy and loving it. And it was like a really good lesson.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you can sit around, like a good friend of mine, Rob Hunter, my engineer, he calls them talent attacks. You know, you can get on stage and have a talent attack, and the musicians might be impressed, but the regular audience, the lay people, could give a damn. You know, and I've always wanted it to be very important that when I'm playing, that I don't have an audience full of musicians and music students. That was always something that was really kind of important to me. And it's strange because I don't really believe that as a musician I should reach out to the audience. It doesn't mean I should treat them like garbage. That's not what I'm saying, but it's when you're trying to make music that is a personal statement of your own, you can't really worry about whether the audience gets it or not, whether the audience likes it or not. You have to do it, but at the same time, I wouldn't want to look out in the audience. Like, there's some musicians we have where, like, the majority of their fan base are, like, people who play the same instrument. And that's kind of like the talent attack crew, you know? And I never wanted to be a part of the talent attack crew because I remember being a part of that when I was with the Mighty Creators, and I didn't dig it very much. I didn't dig it very much.
So was it fun to be in the, I mean, I always thought it would be fun to be in the saxophone section of a band.
It was great in that band.
Yeah, because particularly, like, well, in some of the showier bands, the section would move their horns to the left and to the right in rhythm
that.
And, you know, kind of synchronized. It would be very cool.
We did all of that. And then we were in marching bands and drum and bugle corps.
Don't you love marches? I mean, it's corny.
Oh,
as
we weren't in that
be,
kind of marching
oh,
band.
No?
But I did that as well. Yeah, yeah, those Sousa marches, they're great.
Yeah, they're great, yeah.
I played piccolo when we did Stars and Stripes Forever, and we didn't have a piccolo player. So, and on this one particular performance, George Marks, our music director, wanted to play Stars and Stripes and have the piccolos, the band spreads in the formation and the piccolos play marching down the center of the field. And we only had one piccolo player, and George, because I was like the jack of all trades, when they needed an oboe player for the Christmas thing, he says, you ever played oboe? I says, no. He says, well, you got 6 weeks, here you go. You know, and I stumbled around with it, took a couple of lessons and got good enough to pass for the Christmas play. And it was like the bizarre experience to have this guy just give me these strange instruments and have me do them for these Christmas concerts. I did enjoy it.
Branford Marsalis speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2002 interview with jazz saxophonist Branford Marsalis.
So what was the transition for you from going from the like high school guy playing in local funk and R&B bands to starting to take jazz seriously?
I was at the Berklee College of Music, and I was basically studying production. Playing jazz kind of on the side, not really, you know.
Production, like, as a
funk,
producing records?
Producing records, you know. Quincy Jones. I'm going to be next Quincy Jones. I'm going to hire musicians and put them with certain musicians and, you know, do that thing, you know. Because I did have a knack and still do kind of have a knack for knowing which musicians fit in which musical situations well. And I was playing with this R&B singer named William Bell, who had this big R&B hit called Trying to Love Too. And he had a review. Because with R&B singers, when you have a hit, you have a band, or you have a show, you know, William Bell. When you don't have a hit and you get on the Chitlin circuit, they call it a review, William Bell and his review, and we were part of the review. And I was playing with him in a town called, it's at Worcester.
In New England?
Yeah, it was about 30 minutes, 40 minutes away from Boston. That same night, Wynton was playing with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers at a club in Boston. And I was playing in the band, and we did our show. And at the end of the night, William Bell turns around and says, you know, let's give a round of applause for the boys in the band. And the audience applauded for the boys in the band. And then I left, and I said, I'm going to hear my brother play with Art Blakey. And it struck me, the difference between the two. And in my concert, we were one of the boys in the band. You go to the jazz club, and Art introduces everybody in the band. You know, Wynton Marsalis on trumpet, Billy Pierce on tenor saxophone, Bobby Watson on alto saxophone, Charles Fambro on bass, James Williams on piano. You know, yours truly, you know, Mrs. Blakey's one and only Bambino, yours truly, Arturo Blakey, me. You know, and he would do his thing, and I was kind of struck by it. I said, wow, man, guys, they get introduced and respected as individuals. They get to play solos. You know, it's like a much hipper thing than being one of the boys in the band. So I after that concert, I told Wynton, I says, man, I think I want to play jazz. And he was like, he started laughing. He says, you? Get out of here. Because, you know, it was known that I just could care less. I says, no, I think, man, this concert really inspired me to play. He's like, yeah, okay, whatever, we'll see. Called my dad. So I saw Wynton last night playing, and it was something else, man, and I think I want to start playing jazz. He laughs. No, man, you play jazz? Get out of here. And about 6 months later, they were like, oh, okay, because so, I really got into it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you ended up joining Blakey's band
while
Wynton was still in it. How much longer later was that?
2 years. Mm-hmm. 2 years later.
What did you get from being in Blakey's band?
Blakey was a wonderful band leader.
Yeah, I should say, you know, for people who aren't familiar with it, like the Jazz Messengers, it was considered almost like going to jazz school or something.
Jazz University.
And a lot of great players came out of that band.
A lot of great players. Some Freddie Hubbard and Lee Morgan and Wayne Shorter and I think George Coleman and Bobby Watson and Billy Pierce and Hank Mobley played in that band. And
so what did it do for you?
Art Blakey taught me the function of drums, not only within the context of a rhythm section, but in the context of a group, and how the drummer can actually help the soloist build the solo. And we talked about it. Rather than just being off in the corner doing his own thing, you know, you see those drummers with their heads turned to the left and they're just playing and thinking about what they're playing and not paying attention. He really pays attention to what you play. He paid attention to what you played, and he was on it.
And that gave you certain support and direction?
Well, it made me understand that the music was a lot more intricate than it seems on the outside when you just sit around thinking about playing your own chord changes. And, you know, he would use these really coarse jokes to illustrate points that he would never really explain. You'd have to come to it on your own.
What do you mean?
I was playing a ballad once. There's an old joke about a grandfather and a grandson and some cows walking down a hill. And I'm not really going to get into the joke now because it's too risque. But it's basically a joke that illuminates the difference between young people who rush into things and older people who have learned to take their time. And I'm playing this solo, and Art, when he plays ballads, he would always have a part at the end, and then the musician gets to play a cadenza. And then the cadenza, that's when you get to show your stuff, and you're ripping through. And at the end of one night, he says, "Hey, Bradford," and he tells me this joke. And I'm like, what in the hell is that supposed to mean? It took me a week about to figure it out. It took about a week. And then the next time I played the ballad, he says, "Oh, you figured it out. You're walking now." And I said, "Okay, great." And I believe in that so much now that I don't play cadenzas on ballads because they're pointless. The only reason you play it is to show off your technical prowess. And I mean, my technique is not anywhere near the top 20 as far as I'm concerned. So it doesn't really have, it's not germane to the body of work. So I just eliminate them from my playing completely.
Was it a good thing to be in the band the same time as your brother Wynton?
Well, it was interesting because I really try hard not to delude myself. And sometimes under the guise of honesty, I would delude myself. But in this one, I know for a fact that the only reason that I was even in the band was because Art knew that Wynton really wanted to play in a band with me. And Art thought that if he hired me, then Wynton would stay in his band longer. I have no illusions about this at all. And that's the only reason I got to play with Art.
Here's Branford Marsalis and his brother Wynton in 1982 when they were part of the band Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. This is In Walked Bud.
Branford and Wynton Marsalis with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. We'll hear more about the Marsalis family in the second half of the show. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from the German Information Center, the shortcut to Germany on the web at www.germany.info. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with saxophonist Branford Marsalis and hear from his brother, Wynton Marsalis. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Wimbledon, starring Kirsten Dunst, and Mr. 3000, starring Bernie Mac.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today we're hearing interviews with two Marsalis brothers, saxophonist Branford and trumpeter Winton. The Marsalis family, led by their father Ellis on piano, united for a live recording in August of 2001, along with two other members of the family, Dalfio Marsalis on trombone and Jason Marsalis on drums. Winton introduced one of the songs.
I guess it's been about 15 years. Every time I'm standing up in a group of people, they look at me and say, "So how you and your brother getting along?" And I say, "Do you have a brother? Or do you have sisters?" They say, "Yeah." I say, "How y'all getting along?" And they say, "Oh, yeah, okay. Cain and Abel."
The Marsalis family recorded in 2001 from the CD A Jazz Celebration. Winton Marsalis, the best-known jazz musician and composer of his generation, joined Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers when he was still a teenager. He went on to become the first musician to win Grammy Awards for classical and jazz recordings in the same year. Terry spoke with him in 1994.
What was it like at home when you were growing up? What was your home life like? What was the neighborhood like, atmosphere in the family?
Well, I'll tell you about my block that we lived on Webster Street. We lived on the side of the railroad tracks that the black people lived on. It was in Kendall, Louisiana, a southern town. They have ditches in the street where the ditches dug out. Some black asphalt streets we play street football in. And the sweet shop around the corner where they sell those pigtails and pig feet in a little red jar, and Mary Jane candies and all of that. The gym down the street where we would all play. They had three black Little League football teams, Morgan, Pellerin, and Pollock. And they had about 10 white teams like Wentwood and Driftwood, and we would play them. The people next door to me on the left, once the guy, his wife shot him in the foot. The guy across the street from me, his daughter was pregnant by him. They had a woman used to walk up and down the street named Geraldine, who was crazy. She would be hitting people with switches and stuff, so we would run from her. We were scared of her. There was a woman who lived down the street in a yellow house who killed her husband on the Easter Sunday and shot him. They had a guy named William. He would be out in the street fighting with his wife. He would get drunk and whip her booty on a regular basis. A lot of people would be disillusioned because they weren't working and they were having a hard time struggling.
So did it seem unusual to have a well-balanced family like yours?
Well, our family wasn't necessarily well-balanced.
Oh, okay.
See, we were struggling with dealing with life like everybody else. We weren't that different from other people in our neighborhood. And then my little brother was autistic in Boyer, and he was born. I was 9 years old, and this was like in 1970. So our family life wasn't based on playing music and all this. My father was a struggling musician who was trying to deal with his responsibilities to feed his family. And he and my mother both had a great disillusionment because even though they had grown up in segregation and they were happy because of integration and the breakdown of all these riding in the back of streetcars and stuff, the progress in the society wasn't the way they thought it would be. So this was right in the age when it started to dawn on them that their lives were going to fall into a certain pattern. So they were having to deal with that. And my mother was really dealing with the trauma of my little brother being autistic and how was she going to get help for him. And, You know, my brothers, we would be fighting constantly. We had a good time, though. Now, I'm describing our neighbor because we had a lot of things, but we thought these things were normal. I mean, of course, we knew somebody getting killed wasn't normal, but, like, we also had the Bossy Clay's gas station where you could work and you could go, you know, the gasoline then was like 35 cents a gallon. We had Burton's Pharmacy, which was across from there, where you could go in and try to steal you a little something. And the Clay's Church, where Reverend Clay had about 23 children. And it was a certain type of life that it's never been communicated whenever my family has talked about it. It's always like, yes, and we sat around and Daddy played jazz and Mommy did something and then the kids pulled their horns out. We didn't grow up that way at all. I mean, you'd go out in the street and you would have to put your foot into some booty. You know, you had to deal with what everybody else was dealing with.
Was it hard for you to hold your own in a situation like that? Did being a musician help you at all, help your standing in the neighborhood?
No, well, I wasn't really a musician. They knew me for being able to catch them touchdown passes and shooting that jump shot.
Oh.
See, you didn't, I mean, nobody really liked that kind of music. Mainly, you know, you'd be in the community, like what's going on with Beyond, you know, Marvin Gaye. And I got a little house parties at Sean Jones's house. It was like typical Southern life for the American Negro at that time.
What impact did it have on you when your brother Amboyo was born and he was autistic? Did you spend a lot of time taking care of him? Did you feel that it limited any of your options because you had to bear more responsibility for the family?
No, you know, I didn't. It didn't really have that much of an impact on me because I was so deeply into what I was doing. That the fact that he was autistic, I used to tease my mother all the time and say, something's wrong with that boy. You know, just like teasing him. I didn't know, but he would be kind of strange to me, you know. But then I was 9, 10, 11, you know, a lot of stuff was going on in our house. And then when we found out that he was autistic, we had no idea of what that meant. You see, we were country people. So they said, well, he's autistic. We were like, good, that means he can draw or something. And then he would be hitting his head. You know, he had like a lot of these traits because he's severely autistic. And at one point, my little brother could talk, and then he stopped talking. I can still remember he used to say, get off the table, man. That was like his little thing. And then he stopped talking altogether. And then he just withdrew into this way of being, he's still that way now. And, you know, I remember in my neighborhood, there was a family of boys, all boys. And they were all like gangsters. Like, you know, everybody in the neighborhood was kind of scared of them. But Earl, which was the oldest brother, he taught me how to play basketball. So we were real good friends. And Jack, he was the roughest of all the brothers. Like, this was the type of guy who eventually all of these brothers got killed except for Earl. And I saw Earl later. He said, man, Jack died. Well, me and Jack, we were really tight. But Jack was the type of guy who was just real, real hard, and he very seldom would show emotion. But I remember one day when I was like 11 years old, I was sitting out on the street with my bicycle. I was 12. And me and Jack and I, we were talking. He said, man, where's your little brother, the one that's crazy? I said, my little brother's not crazy, man. He's autistic. He said, man, let me tell you something. If I had a brother like that, I would have him on my bike right now, and I would take him all around this city. So, like, that was something. It was a certain emotion that came out of him that I didn't expect. And to be honest, I never have had that type of relationship with my little brother. Like, where I really would take him around.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were always running up and down. And if you take my little brother out, you know, he would, when he was younger, you never knew what reaction he would have to being in different circumstances.
Wynton Marsalis is my guest. Why did trumpet become your instrument when you did start to play?
Well, that's the instrument that I had because my father had gotten a trumpet. Al Hurt gave me a trumpet on my 6th birthday. And I didn't play it that much because I wasn't serious about it. But once I became serious, you know, I already had the instrument. So I didn't mind playing it.
So the music you heard around you, heard the contemporary music that your father was playing. And there was the pop music on the radio. What else was around you?
Well, once I became a musician?
No, when you were young, when you were just starting out.
Well, we had all of those kind of little Walt Disney things of, like, symphony music, but I didn't really like any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Walter Cronkite was on the news, they'd play that Beethoven. Boom, 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 boom.
Right.
I mean, I can remember
Did
hearing
you like that?
That. Yeah, I always liked that. So even to this day, and then once I started to learn in high school about Beethoven, he was my favorite composer, and even now I love his music. And I can remember just as a baby hearing that theme. And mainly it was pop music that we heard: James Brown, Marvin Gaye, Stevie, and Sam and Dave. We lived next to a barroom and a restaurant pool hall. And before we moved to Kendall, we lived in a place called Hanson City, Louisiana. And there was a woman named Miss Mary who had like two of the biggest breasts you ever saw in your life. So I used to like to always lay up underneath her. And she liked to fix me shrimp, boiled shrimp, you know. And in Louisiana, they have the boiled shrimp that you like to eat. So I can always remember they always had like some Sam and Dave on the radio. On the jukebox. And you know how when you're a kid and you walk into a ballroom, like those ballrooms with the black and red tile, mm-hmm. real country where they serve fried catfish and stuff, you always had that smell of beer. It was like in a place you didn't think you were supposed to be. So since we lived next door to them and sometimes they would babysit us, I would go there in the daytime and I can remember the music that they played on the jukebox.
Wynton Marsalis speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. Coming up, the conclusion of our interview with his brother Branford. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with saxophonist Branford Marsalis. He has a new CD of ballads called Eternal on the Marsalis Music label. They spoke in 2002.
Now, Wynton is younger than you are, but he was...
Most people assume he's older.
But he was more serious about jazz before you were.
Oh, yeah, way more.
And he got you into the Blakey Band, and then you played in his band. Was it awkward for you then, being the older brother, knowing that your younger brother... was making more headway in jazz and was more serious about it sooner than you were?
No, because I wasn't. You know what I mean? I think it would have been more difficult if I had been really trying and
right.
I was really serious. Because then it's an issue of, well, I'm just not good enough.
Was your temperament musically different, too, about like how serious you needed to be?
I was just a strange person. And I was really into music then. I wasn't really into music the way my brother is. We think about it in different ways. I was more into the sort of almost metaphysical interaction that good musicians have with one another. And I was a huge fan of music. I used to listen and still do listen to all types of music, just using trying to find ways to incorporate those things organically. Not peripherally, but organically into my conception. And Wynton was going headstrong into the quintet concept, this particular band, writing songs for the band, arrangements. He was always like, you don't write songs, you should need to write songs. I mean, I really wasn't into writing songs at that time. I was still checking out music and trying to figure out what it was that I wanted to do musically. I wasn't so sure what that was, and I wasn't really ready to put the lion's share of my energy into something until I was absolutely certain what it was.
It's interesting hearing you talk about your musical development and how jazz is something you got interested in, you know, in your late teens, after when you were in college. You have left jazz a couple of times. and, you know, in 1985, you joined Sting's band.
Right.
And you spent, I forget how long, on The Tonight Show as the band leader there.
Years.
And although you were often playing jazz on the show, it still wasn't within the jazz world, mm-hmm. per se. And then you've done, you know, like your Buckshot LaFunk music, which
right.
is a like jazz hip-hop hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things that the jazz world were necessarily really enthusiastic about.
Right.
And I think it's fair to say, with some of this stuff, you were perceived as almost like betraying the jazz community by leaving it,
yeah.
for instance, and joining Sting. But the way you're describing your musical interest, it sounds more like a continuum than a turning your back
on
something.
Well, it is a continuum. And my mother said something to me which holds true to me to this day. We joke about it now. I was 7 or 8, 5, and, you know, you're going to practice. I was 8. And I was playing piano. And I had a recital a duo recital with a young lady named Barbara Krause, and we had to play this piano duo. And my mother's, you know, you're going to practice. I said, I got it. I got the piece. I don't feel like practicing. You know, and she was just on me. You're going to fail if you don't practice. You're going to. So the night before the concert, she's like, are you going to work on this piece or not? I says, no, I'm not. And she grabs me by the shoulders and she says, you know what the problem with you is? You are a little boy who wants to do what he wants to do.
That's great.
And I never forgot it. So then the concert comes up and we come out on stage. And when I come out on stage, my mother gets up and walks out of the room. So I'm thinking, well, humph, she's just trying to, you know, be mad at me because I didn't practice. I'll show her. And I mean, I aced the piece, you know. It's not like we're talking about Rachmaninoff here. It was like 8-year-old stuff. I mean, I played it. And then she was looking in the like one of those doors with the little square window. She was looking in the square. I mean, now that I know my mother a lot better, I realize she gets nervous for us.
Right.
And she was so nervous she couldn't sit. And I, you know, like when the first night of the Tonight Show came, I mean, she wouldn't even fly to L.A. She was like, I'm too nervous. She wouldn't even watch the show. She was in the other room, and she would call my dad and say, how's he doing out there, honey? So he's sitting there. He looks fine. She just wouldn't. She's just that nervous. But at the time, I was like, oh, so she's going to try to, you know, stick it to me, huh? So when we played the piece and we finished, we bowed, and I looked up and saw my mother in the window, and I stuck my tongue out at her. So I've always been like, look, you know, I've always been a little boy who's going to do what he wants to do. And in my musical choices, it has never been a dream of mine to appease or please the jazz community. It has never been a dream of mine to appease or please anyone other than me and my immediate family.
Now, you were saying before that you realized after playing in a lot of R&B bands and then seeing your brother Wynton playing with Art Blakey, you realized, you know, in the R&B bands, you were like one of the boys in the band, where if you're playing with a jazz group, you're all significant musicians on stage playing something together.
Mm-hmm.
When you, for instance, joined Sting, did you feel like you were one of the boys in the band again?
No. That was a very, very different thing.
Was it?
We were an integral part of the sound.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like there was a pre-existing sound and we just came in and filled in the parts.
What about on The Tonight Show? How did you feel on the band? Did you feel like an integral part of the show?
No, because the band is not an integral part of the show. The musical director is an integral part of the show. But the music is essentially, it's just the it's pure entertainment. I mean, when the commercials come on, you know, and the audience is like, I'd never seen anything like it before, because they come to the show and they stand in long lines, and if you ever go to the show, there's little TV screens, little monitors all over the place, so people can see, and it's mostly for the people way in the back, and I mean, people love Jay, and they stand in this line to see Jay, and Jay is not even 75 feet from them. And they go, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, the lights go down, and the thing comes up, and all the heads go straight up to the television monitors. And the man is 75 feet from him. He's right there. They don't even look. And then, because it's like a semi-live show, I mean, they don't stop the show for anything unless, like, a light falls and tries to almost kill someone or something. They're putting the commercials in, because they have a narrow window. You know, they're putting the commercials in live during the break, because they have to send the feed off to the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, the band's playing, the Jay's getting makeup, and people are talking. And I mean, I would be curious enough to want to see what it's like to put on a show. Most of the people in the audience, they look at the commercials, which they can't hear, and they just keep looking up. And it's just the strangest experience to turn around while the band's playing and realize that 70% of your audience is looking up. You know, so it's just a very... It's entertainment.
Right.
It's entertainment in its purest form. It's not, you know, artistic or anything like that.
So tell me, has your father been really pleased over the years that you've come to love jazz and play it?
I mean, I just confused the hell out of my poor dad. My dad was just, he didn't understand me. Now he does. But my whole career to him was just one, because my dad is, he has two words. I mean, he always said, I mean, like typical Ellis Marsalis fashion. He says, yeah, man, you know, you and Winton are interesting because, see, Winton's a concrete sequential, and you're a random abstract. I actually named a record Random Abstract because he was saying, I said, what are you talking about, man? Just talk to me like I'm your son. What was this concrete sequential crap, you know? And he went through it, you know, went just things like A, B, C, D, E, F, and you're like A, F, B, Z. And he just didn't understand that because if you have to really, he's a concrete sequential. So it just seemed like, it seemed just rampant, just like a pell-mell kind of thing. Like, what in the hell is he doing?
Branford Marsalis, speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. He has a new CD on the Marsalis music label called Eternal. Coming up, reviews of two new films opening this week, Mr. 3000 and Wimbledon. This is Fresh Air. Two new movies feature athletes at the end of their careers making one last attempt to get back in the arena. In Mr. 3000, the self-centered baseball ex-superstar, played by Bernie Mac, learns to think about the team. In Wimbledon, the unself-centered tennis non-starter, played by Paul Bettany, learns to think about himself and Kirsten Dunst. David Edelstein has this review.
We Americans like winners, which is why our sports movies end with fists pumping and crowds going nuts. But we also like warm, fuzzy life lessons, which is why our winners don't win because they're better and more ruthless athletes. They win because they're spiritually more evolved. This week, two very charming go-for-it sports pictures test the formula. Not enough to explode it. These are big studio movies. And did I mention that Americans like winners? But they add dissonances, sour notes that make the music a little sweeter. Mr. 3000 is a surprisingly laid-back and even morose comedy about an arrogant SOB who gets his comeuppance. Stan Ross, played by Bernie Mac, is a winner in part because he puts his numbers ahead of the team. When this jerk gets his 3,000th hit, he promptly announces his retirement in the middle of a pennant race. The movie stretches credulity by imagining a player could do that and not be run out of town. But Stan gets forgiven much, except by the sports writers who elect the members of the Baseball Hall of Fame. And then 9 years later comes the news that his best claim to inclusion, those 3,000 hits that put him in the company of the immortals, is based on a counting error. Three hits short, the pudgy 47-year-old goes back into baseball, and the last-place Milwaukee Brewers welcome him because he's their best chance to fill the stadium. Here's the cocky ex-superstar reporting to the trainer. You have to imagine the look of panic on Bernie Mac's face in the middle of his first push-up.
How many push-ups can you do?
One arm or two. Well, I'll tell you what, man. Last time I counted, man, what was it, about 40, 50?
Mm-hmm. I got $5 in my pocket. Says you can't give me 10.
That's easy money. Back up, man.
Bogey, you better help your boy down.
He didn't help me in.
Okay, well, that's one.
How many is that?
Oh, I don't know. I'd say 40, 50.
That's four. Come on, Stan. You got this, man.
Ho, ho, ho. Your knee touch, man. That's a girl push-up. That don't count.
You see my knee touch, Boca?
Who said girl push-ups don't count?
Yeah, who said girl push-ups don't count?
Bernie Mac is a great comic presence because he projects something lordly and arrogant, and yet those eyes, which never seem to blink, flash panic as they scan the crowd for signs of approval. His prickliness tells you his confidence is a little dicey. Mr. 3000 is about Stan's realization that the enemy is his own ego, a painful lesson, and one that doesn't end on the high note we're expecting. The movie, directed by Charles Stone III, who made the low-budget winner Drumline, doesn't have the high-energy raunch that Max fans might hope for, and there's some formula swill mixed in. But to see the hero repeatedly taunted by a giant sausage, that's the team's mascot, it's a macho deflation you can savor. Wimbledon's hero needs to be more, not less macho. He's a fair Englishman, Peter Colt, played by Paul Bettany of Master and Commander. Peter is a one-time 11th-ranked English tennis star who just never rose to the championship. Maybe it was because he's rich, and his father always said that tennis was a gentleman's sport. Peter doesn't have any drive whatsoever until he meets a haughty American tennis star, Lizzie Bradbury, played by Kirsten Dunst, who puts winning ahead of everything. It's a strange thing, this movie. It's about an athlete who falls in love in the course of a tournament, and as a result of those warm and fuzzy new feelings, finds the killer instinct to obliterate his opponents. He even obliterates his best friend, who says admiringly, "You hit from the soul, the heart. Something's happened to you." So all you coaches and managers out there, to make your players kill, get them to fall in love. Wimbledon is a bit of a philosophical muddle, but the climactic tennis scenes are galvanically convincing, with some long and nerve-wracking volleys, and the rest of it works as Notting Hill with balls and rackets. The Englishman gets to bat his eyes and deliver farcical lies very badly, and the American female celebrity is tantalizing and elusive, just like America to the Brits. The best thing about it is the pale and gangly Bettany, who's high-strung in a way that women will find madly attractive and men madly agreeable. Above all, we Americans like our winners winning.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Paris Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publishers of Emma Donoghue's Life Mask, a love triangle set in London's high society of the late 18th century from the author of Slammerkin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, 3 women, 10 kids, and a nation's drive to end welfare. We'll talk to New York Times reporter Jason DeParle about his new book, American Dream. He follows a trio of mothers in Milwaukee to see how welfare reform changes their lives. Join us for the next Fresh Air.